Hello, it's John Dennis on Monday the 27th of April. Today, has an outbreak of deadly swine flu in Mexico spread to other parts of the world?
The government has said that there's a surprisingly high number of people being infected who are healthy young adults.
Also today, revealed repeated safety failings at the UK's main nuclear submarine base.
There is a culture of rule breaking at the plant that they routinely break procedures that are meant to, you know, protect their staff and protect the environment.
And get ready for an age of austerity, David Cameron's warning to the Tories.
The age of irresponsibility is giving way to an age of austerity. Labour are spent. The money has run out.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the headlines and the papers.
The Mexican government believes more than 100 people have now died from the outbreak of swine flu, but this has not yet been confirmed by tests. Canada is the third country to confirm it has human cases, but there have been reports of the possibility around the world from Spain to New Zealand. In Mexico itself, most public life and events have been closed down, including schools and sports matches. Many countries are planning to put anyone suffering the flu symptoms into quarantine. The British Chief Medical Officer has sent out a warning to hospitals. We'll be hearing from Mexico City later in Guardian Daily. The President of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, has warned the poor of the world will suffer most from the current global economic crisis. Internationally agreed plans to improve the life and economies of developing countries are under threat.
Before this crisis, the Millennium Development Goals on overcoming poverty by 2015 already look like a stretch. Our latest research shows that most of these 8 globally agreed goals are unlikely to be met. These include those related to hunger, child and maternal mortality, education, and progress in combating HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other major diseases. An additional 55 to 90 million people will be trapped in extreme poverty in 2009. The number of chronically hungry people is expected to climb to over 1 billion this year.
The president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick. In the ocean off Africa, the crew of an Italian cruise ship have fought off an attack by Somali pirates with pistol fire as well as hoses. It's the first time weapons have been used to drive off the pirates. Members of a private Israeli security force were on board the cruise ship Melody when it was attacked just after the 1,500 passengers had had dinner. The ship was then escorted to port by a Spanish warship. The massive American carmaker Chrysler may now be able to combine with the Italian Fiat after the Auto Workers Union made a deal on cuts in jobs and possibly wages. The deal needs the government to finance it, but the two companies and staff have been given a deadline at the end of April to come up with an agreement. The Defence Secretary John Hutton's announcing a rebalancing of the armed forces today. Special forces like the SAS are to be boosted in a strategy to take on the terrorists. Mr. Hutton believes the rule book of traditional conflict has been torn up by the use of new tactics in Iraq and Afghanistan, such as female suicide bombers. The veteran Manchester United and Wales midfielder Ryan Giggs has won the Professional Footballers Association Award for Player of the Year. Even though he's now 35, he beat several of his younger teammates to the title. But it's Jenson Button, the Formula One racing driver, who gets his face on a couple of front pages this morning. In a storming year, he won his third Grand Prix out of four in Bahrain for the Braun Mercedes team. In the Times, the headline is Button Up, Jenson Scorches to Desert Victory, while the Guardian calls him Red Hot Button for beating the pain of a burn on his left buttock caused by a combination of the car and the desert. He said that it was the best win of his career. Otherwise, every morning paper leads with the swine flu outbreak. Swine flu sweeps the globe, it says in The Independent. Call for global action as outbreak spreads in The Guardian. Is swine flu already here? Asks The Mail. While The Sun reports 2 suspected cases in Scotland, saying that there's a UK alert. The Mirror lays it down with the bold headline, Pig Sick. The Mirror says tourists are fleeing Mexico. The Express reports experts warning 120 million people could die. But that's an extreme view, according to the World Health Organization. It's holding an emergency conference today. Two other of yesterday's stories also find a place. The FT reports David Cameron's speech, saying he foresees a painful budget when he thinks he'll have to take over. The Mail puts a laughing picture of Jonathan Ross and his wife beside the headline, Whining Ross is snubbed at the BAFTAs, gleefully reporting that Harry Hill won the award Ross was up for. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
An outbreak of human swine flu has resulted in the closure of schools and universities in parts of Mexico. Symptoms include a fever of more than 100 degrees and coughing. Well, so far, the virus is known to have killed 81 people, all of them in Mexico. But suspected cases have been reported as far away as New Zealand and New York. The World Health Organization says it has the potential to become a worldwide pandemic. Joe Tuckman is in Mexico City.
Well, we know that it is a never-before-seen strain of swine flu, which was the virus that was behind the pandemic in 1918 that killed 50 million people across the world. I mean, this is a completely new strain. It was identified in labs in Atlanta and Canada on Thursday after the Mexican government sent samples up there that it was worried about because of an increase in the number of flu cases over the last 3 weeks. That diagnosis or that result led the government to suddenly impose all these emergency precautionary measures that we have today.
And give us some idea about what they consist of.
Well, they're kind of expanding all the time. I mean, the first measure was to close schools, everything from nurseries up to universities, completely through the capital. Now, that was originally just on Friday. It's now been extended until May the 6th and also extended out of Mexico City to another state some way away. I mean, not even directly bordering the metropolitan area. So there's the school ban, there's concerts have been cancelled, football matches are being played behind closed doors, public events of all sorts have been cancelled, museums are closed, libraries are closed. People are still going to work. Government's asked employers to be understanding if people don't turn up, either because they've got flu symptoms or because they can't find anybody to look after their children at such short notice. But for the moment, in theory, economic activity is still going on.
And what's the mood like? I mean, it must be very worrying for people.
It is very worrying. I mean, it's a very strange mood. It's not. I haven't seen any signs of panic. It's more a kind of contained terror. Nobody knows. There's so little information. There's a lot of distrust in what the government's saying. There's rumors flying around all over the place that actually the death toll is much higher. The government on Saturday night said the death toll was probably 81 people who had died from the virus in the 1,324 suspected cases. So there's rumors flying around that's under-reporting. But nobody knows much about it. Nobody knows where it is. It's not confined to specific areas. We don't know the profile of the kind of people that are getting infected. The government has said that there's a surprisingly high number of people being infected who are healthy young adults, which has all the experts particularly worried because that kind of profile is typical of a pandemic. A normal epidemic would just affect primarily affect the more vulnerable people in society, the very young or the very old.
Joe Tuckman in Mexico City. Well, no one in the United States is known to have died from the outbreak, but there have been a number of suspected cases of swine flu. In Washington, The Guardian's Chris McGreal.
Well, several things have happened in the past 24 hours. Here in Washington, the United States has declared a health emergency. After officials said that the virus, the swine flu virus, is now so widespread it's unlikely to be contained. The World Health Organization has declared an international public health emergency and called on governments to increase their monitoring of swine flu. At its epicenter in Mexico, the death toll has risen, and there's new cases reported as far away from the epicenter as Israel, New Zealand and Scotland.
Are the US authorities prepared?
They say they are. They say that they can use the plan that they had in place for the avian flu 5 years ago. They have certain drugs such as Tamiflu, which is an antiretroviral drug. which can catch the disease early on. They say that there's emergency measures to put in place, such as closing schools, limiting public gatherings. They're already educating people on the standard ways of dealing with flu, such as washing your hands, not going to work if you're sick, avoiding sneezing over people. But it's not clear if this does become an epidemic on a huge scale, how well prepared they are or not. It's many years since they've had to deal with something like this.
And are there any signs, Chris, that this issue could become create political difficulties for the Obama administration?
Well, I think it's like anything else. If the government handles it badly, people will blame the government. It says it has all these plans in place, that they've been in place for many years. But I suppose that if it were to become a crisis such as Mexico, where you now have people not going to work, most public buildings are closed, restaurants are closed, the schools are closed, there'll be a sense of disaster, I suppose, in a sense, and people will start to hold the administration accountable.
Chris McGreal, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/world. Also on The Guardian's website, Patrick Barkham on the decline of the British butterfly at guardian.co.uk/environment. Lynn Gardner looks at the state of theatre outside London. She asks whether regional reps have got lazy. Does their content live up to their flashy new buildings? Find out at guardian.co.uk/theatre. And Jermaine Greer on the German artist Martin Kippenberger at guardian.co.uk/arts. There have been a series of serious breaches of safety involving Britain's nuclear submarines. Radioactive waste has been leaking. There have been broken pipes and waste tanks at the UK's main nuclear submarine base at Faslane near Glasgow. The safety breaches have been revealed in documents released under the Freedom of Information Act to Channel 4 News. With the details is Rob Edwards.
Essentially, it tells us that Faslane has been something of a mess. And it's in a rather dilapidated state. And the most, I think, the most damaging revelation is actually that that there is a culture of rule breaking at the plant, that they routinely break procedures that are meant to, you know, protect their staff and protect the environment.
How serious is the threat to human health and the environment?
I don't think that the leaks that have taken place from the evidence we've seen have actually themselves made a serious threat. The leaks themselves have been quite small, and that's something that the Ministry of Defence and the regulator, the Scottish Environment Protection Agency, agree on. But the point is that that's really a matter of luck rather than judgment. That the leaks shouldn't have taken place, and the regulator, SEPA, says they show that there's an inadequate management of radioactive waste at Faslane, and that they're pressing the MOD very hard to try and do something about it.
SEPA, that's the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency. Is there anything they can do about this?
Well, one of the most interesting things about this story, in my view, is that at the end of the day, there's nothing they can do. They can exhort, they can pressurise, they can publicise, but they don't have the legal power to force the MOD to do anything, because military sites like Faslane are exempt from the radiation protection legislation. And that is something that worries SEPA, and which is why SEPA has itself been urging the government, and has urged the government in the past, to change the law so that it can have these powers to legally regulate the site.
Another thing revealed by these documents is that the Devonport submarine base in Plymouth has been earmarked for closure, which leaves Faslane as the UK's only nuclear submarine base.
Yes, that's correct. One of the documents released is a sort of forward look as to how the waste will be handled in the future. And that reveals that what many people have suspected in recent days is that a decision has already been taken by the MOD to shift the Trafalgar-class nuclear submarines from Devonport to Faslane, which is, some people would argue, bad news for Devonport, but it could be bad news for Faslane, because obviously it's got these old ramshackle and leaking radioactive waste facilities, which will now have more radioactive waste to handle.
And there's a political head of steam building up in Scotland to close Faslane.
Yes, there is. The Scottish National Party minority government in Scotland has always been opposed to Trident and nuclear weapons, and it set up a working party to explore ways of doing that, and I expect that the revelations about the poor safety and leaks at Faslane will be pursued by that working group. Of course, the problem is that the Scottish government doesn't have the power to kick out Trident as it would like to do, because it's a matter controlled by the UK government. But it's certainly causing a lot of political conflict.
What's the Ministry of Defence said about all this?
The Ministry of Defence is has pointed out that the leaks themselves have been relatively low, and there's no proof that they've caused any damage to health or the environment. And they've said that they're embarking on a program, of which the released report is part, of course. They're embarking on a program to improve safety and bring the plant up to modern standards.
Rob Edwards, and you can see Rob's report tonight on Channel 4 News. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, why climate change might be good news for British wind farms.
This could be an example of a wind farm project that gets a go-ahead, otherwise could be scrapped. So it's very good for the wind farm industry.
But first, David Cameron says he would preside over a government of thrift in an age of austerity. Addressing the Conservative Spring Conference in Cheltenham yesterday, he said the Tories would slash budgets to reduce public borrowing, which the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, said in his budget speech last week would hit £175 billion this year. David Cameron didn't even rule out raising taxes. Nicholas Watt is our chief political correspondent.
Well, I think that the speech that David Cameron delivered in Cheltenham at the party's Spring Forum, and indeed a speech by George Osborne, the Shadow Chancellor, were really the gloomiest speeches that I've heard from those two since they took over the leadership of the Conservative Party 3 years ago. And they essentially are preparing us for what they're calling this new age of austerity. And they say that this isn't just going to be sort of a little bit of trimming here and a little bit of trimming there. It's going to be what they're calling a complete cultural change in the way that government operates, both nationally and locally. And when the Conservatives have talked in the past about how we in an ideal world believe in a low tax economy, they've never really sort of gone into specifics. But David Cameron did, in his speech to the Spring Forum, actually begin to outline some specifics, and a few examples are quite interesting. He talked about how tax credits, which are the main mechanism that Gordon Brown has used for tackling poverty, they should no longer be paid out, he said, to households who have an income of more than £50,000. So that means a couple who each earn £25,000 would no longer be entitled to tax credits that top up their income. He also talked about how the NHS electronic patients record, this is this £12 billion system that's designed to ensure that people's medical records are stored across the NHS, saying those should be replaced by individuals storing their medical records online. They're talking about web-based versions of that. Now, what some critics of that will say is, well, actually, you do need your medical records to be stored by the NHS so that whatever stage you're treated at through the NHS, be it in hospital or your GP surgery, your records can be easily accessed. So these are pretty tough ideas that David Cameron's talking about.
Did he actually go as far as to mention spending cuts?
Well, the Conservatives are not getting into specific figures of saying we're going to cut this amount of billions from their plans if they get into government, because they're saying that's what Labour wants us to do. The phrase that George Osborne uses is, Gordon Brown wants me to write the budget for 2010 now, because then he can A, rip me apart, and B, in a year's time, the world will have changed. It's interesting that the Liberal Democrats, they did write their budget, not that they're going to get into power, they talked about £20 billion of efficiency savings. They've now had to rip that up. You can't write a budget before the moment that you're actually really going to do it. So no, they weren't getting into specific figures of this amount will come off the Ministry of Defence budget, this amount will come off the Ministry of Justice budget, but they did talk about principles. And Philip Hammond, who's the Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, he talked about how it's important to shrink debt as a proportion of GDP at a faster rate than the government. The government wants to get this below the great 40% figure, but not until 2032, and Philip Hammond says we'll do it a lot quicker than that, which would obviously have very serious implications for the level of public spending.
David Cameron also said at the weekend that Gordon Brown's plan to replace MPs' second homes allowance with a daily attendance payment is now dead. Where does this leave Thursday's vote on the Prime Minister's proposals?
Well, it's interesting. David Cameron's language was pretty clear-cut, wasn't it? He had that meeting with Gordon Brown last week and Nick Clegg, where they were meant to sort of thrash out a consensus. And David Cameron said, no, this idea, the Prime Minister's central idea, which is a daily allowance, as he said, that's dead in the water. Where it leaves it is looking pretty tricky. Gordon Brown thought, when he did that YouTube video last week, that he would seize the political initiative, come up with an idea, and the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats would have to back it, because if they didn't, then he'd be able to portray them as the barriers, as blockers of reform. I think where Gordon Brown miscalculated is how unpopular his idea is. This daily allowance, people are just saying, well, that's just what happens in Brussels, and we all know what the Brussels gravy train is like. So his idea has gone down like a lead balloon, and that gives the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats the space to oppose it. Now, Downing Street is saying the Prime Minister still intends to go ahead with this vote on Thursday. Well, if he goes on with it at the moment, he'll probably lose it. So I think there will be discussions, there will be trimming at the edges, because at the moment it seems to be pretty difficult to see how the Prime Minister can get it through.
Nick Watt. Just a quick mention that you can follow Guardian Daily as we're putting the show together at twitter.com/Guardian Daily. An unexpected quirk of climate change has provided a much-needed boost to offshore wind farm developers. According to a new analysis of NASA satellite data, while northern parts of the British Isles are as windswept as ever, southern England, which has historically been relatively becalmed, is getting windier. I asked our business reporter Tim Webb why this was.
Well, that's a good question. And even the scientists who developed this technology and have come up with these findings don't know the exact reasons, other than saying it's a feature of climate change and shifting weather patterns.
So, I mean, a positive impact potentially of climate change is that if southern England's getting windier, we can have more wind farms.
That's very much true, and it comes at a very good time for the wind industry, which finds itself in dire straits. London Array, which would be the world's largest offshore wind farm in the Thames Estuary, project developers E.ON say that the project may not go ahead because it could be too expensive. So this could be an example of a wind farm project that gets a go-ahead, otherwise could be scrapped. So it's very good for the wind farm industry. And also, as well as showing that winds are getting stronger in the southern part of the North Sea, this data, if it's shown to be accurate, also would be the first set of historic and accurate data that goes back over a long period of time, because currently there is no way of accurately measuring offshore wind speeds.
Broadly speaking, is it correct to say that the windier it is, the more energy a wind farm could produce?
Yes, that's true. Although if it becomes so windy and conditions are so stormy that it's very hard to maintain the wind turbines, send boats out to repair them, then that's not a positive for the developers. So they want the winds to be strong but not stormy.
Tim Webb, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.